sharing several different words, and moksha was one of them that was similar to them or something. Different levels of nirvana, enlightenment, something like that.
Oh, yeah, it says on the web, freedom from birth and death. In Hinduism, liberation from the bondage of worldly action is based on detachment and freedom. So it's getting off the wheel of rebirth. So he would discuss, Bharati would discuss ideas about moksha as real or just a belief. I mean, I don't know if that's meant as a question. I guess he would discuss them as ideas. Agahananda had no serious disagreement with what Krishnamurti said about meditation, sex, the non-importance of God, yoga, and everything gurus talk about. Krishnamurti, Agahananda commented, did not tell anyone to meditate or not to meditate. Bharati said that Krishnamurti did not tell anyone to meditate or not to meditate, nor did he issue moral warrants or give religious pep talks as the Swamis did.
I remember one time somebody asked Krishnamurti when he meditated and how often he meditated. And he paused for a minute and he says, I never cease. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of the Bible statement of pray without ceasing.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, he's in constant meditation.
Yeah. McLuhan said the same thing. He said he was always 24/7 in dialogue with God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just like to sizzle.
Yeah. you mean that?
I just like to zzz.
Yeah, but are you saying that's what we're saying Krishnamurti meant, or you are going to...
I'm just making my personal statement about living in heaven all the time.
Okay, you like to sizzle. Zizzle. So he's saying that Krishnamurti didn't give moral warrants or religious pep talks as the Swamis did. However, Agahananda says about Krishnamurti that Krishnamurti did talk Vedanta. And that is said, defined as a highly sophisticated, modern, non-scriptural, but nonetheless authentic kind of Vedanta.
Mm-hmm.
Highly sophisticated, modern, non-scriptural. Among the gurus of the world, Agahananda saw Krishnamurti as a no-nonsense man. Perhaps.
Well, see, one of the things that Krishnamurti, I think, said this, or somebody said it about him, is that in order to be really with it, you have to be totally positive. Or, in Krishnamurti's case, totally negative.
Who said this?
And
who's saying this?
It may have been Krishnamurti.
He said that you have to be totally positive or totally negative.
Yes, and that he preferred to take the totally negative. In other words, not this, not this, not
yeah.
this, not
yeah.
this, not this. You can name anything and I'll say not this.
Yeah, he's a racer head. You know that movie, Eraserhead? You ever heard of that?
Yeah, but in the sense of, in his meditation, as a thought comes up,
not this.
There's an examination of it and its source, but not its significance.
Right.
So, and if you get to where you give it significance before you've looked at it so deeply that the significance is gone, then you're on the hook for that. So that's even though it's spiritual, it's not all the way. So there's lots of very people that are very spiritual that have gone quite a ways in, and so they have a grid that's more spiritual there that you tune into. But if you start challenging it, they don't necessarily want to look deeper.
They still find significance. They still have the significance.
And you see, the point is...
You agree with that?
Yes, but one can only challenge and discover by yourself.
Yeah.
That somebody else can challenge, but it doesn't mean anything until you look at it and you unhook it. And you only unhook it when you know that you've looked. And it's, and that's why I've said it's very difficult to ask somebody to become aware. Look at all the work they have to do. and it, to even put the description and the word power of the neuro-linguistic reactions to work before they even, it's almost like crippling them before they can do it.
Yeah. You're saying you're putting the neurolinguistic reactions, you're asking them to, say that again?
Well, it's like, you know that about the neurolinguistic reactions, and so if you use words, they have a neurolinguistic reaction to whoever you're talking to.
Yeah.
And some of that reaction may be your own that you're sending along with the word, and so they're stuck with your problem too, as well as their own. That's why I don't like hypnosis.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a process of hypnosis, but the operator with hypnosis transfers neurolinguistic information of his own, whether he likes it or not, and so that it just doesn't work right.
Right, and your point is you have to do it by yourself. That's your point here.
You look into things. You have to have enough interest to look into things from your own examination, your own observing. As you hear, he used to use the phrase of as the speaker speaks and you hear the words, you trot out all of your significant information to compare with it.
Yes.
And if you do that, you haven't been listening. If you're listening, what you'll do is see your mind doing that.
Yeah.
If you're seeing your mind trot out all this stuff, then you're having an experiencing process that may have connected with the speaker's words, but the phenomena of looking into the conditioning behind the words that you're using to trot out against whatever's been said is a phenomenon. If you catch that and you do it a few times and you get to have a lifestyle like that, then you can keep the debris out of the house, pretty much.
Yeah. Amen. He says, among the gurus of the world, Agananda Sar Krishnamurti is a no-nonsense man, perhaps the only one. So again, you know, Bob Carr is getting great support and sense of certainty for studying Krishnamurti from another person.
Yes.
So this chapter ends with this last paragraph where he says, "Well, I thought that was something for Agananda to say after knowing him for the past month or so. He was impressed that Agananda said that about Krishnamurti. Of course, whatever he said didn't affect the way I felt about Krishnamurti's teachings. I was completely in love with Krishnamurti's image, the man who had attained liberation, the man who rejected theosophy and the whole occult presentation, including the idea of the masters, the man who broke away from every form of authority." And so the point is, here's the detachment that Bob is putting in here. He is saying that he was in love with Krishnamurti. He would not have said that himself at that time. He was too involved with it. But now we're getting the point that he's later going to fall out of love with Krishnamurti. Okay, that's the later story.
Well, he's going to go through life experiences that have certain significances, and these significances, I have a way of putting it. Something somewhere inflamed his mind, and Krishnamurti often warned us about inflaming the mind. But somewhere he inflamed the mind, and when the
who
mind
inflamed?
Is in,
wait, who inflamed? You mean Carr inflamed his own mind? Is that what you're saying?
Something inflamed his mind. Whether he did it or something outside or some situation, some reaction, somewhat. In other words, in my own case, I feel that he had snap judgments in certain areas where he had made mistakes, and that somebody following in a trail, even though it's different, was a mistake.
You're talking about Bob or Krishnamurti?
Yeah, Bob and me, I'm talking about particularly. That's why he didn't like my going into trance. But he also...
You're describing Bob's reaction to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
But to others, too. But I mean...
snap judgments, yeah.
Yeah, so... Well, snap decisions that involved his emotional judgment. And, of course, I knew his psyche pretty deeply. I think I started to tell you about his first acid session.
We're going to get that in a minute, yeah.
He said that last time.
No, but we're there. We've ended this chapter. But just continue. Your point is you're saying that he had an inflamed mind.
No, if a situation came about wherein he had an inflamed mind, then some kind of a transition of falling out of love with Krishnamurti could have occurred. You see what I mean?
Now, what is the source of the inflamed mind? When he was young? I don't know why
you're... I don't know. It's like you have to be aware that the mind can become inflamed. Now, what causes it to become inflamed is absolutely totally different for every person.
Right, but you're saying that something about Krishnamurti inflamed Bob's mind.
No, I think Bob's mind was quieted down by Krishnamurti, but something else that came along, or something that wasn't fully tended to before, flared back up or something.
Right.
But at least it inflamed enough that he made some kind of an anti-Krishnamurti move.
Right, and it was inflamed by UG Krishnamurti. Yeah, that's what the later part.
Yeah, with me, I looked at it and I didn't care. It's like Krishnamurti was Krishnamurti, but he had taught me certain things that I used, and I used them. And if I was fair, I would say this process I got from Krishnamurti.
If you were fair, you said.
Yeah, if I wasn't fair, I wouldn't tell anybody where I got it and go off and show off. And that's what it would be a show off. And you see, that's enough to inflame your mind, too.
Right.
And so I, as something that Bob said about that Las Vegas trip and what happened to him, he says, what happened is I was very clever. And all of a sudden, my cleverness caught up with me and was faster than I could handle.
Right.
And that's what got him into all this. All right, if there was something down the line that caused him to discount Krishnamurti, it must have been somebody could have inflamed his mind because there might have been something in there to inflame. I'm not sure what that would be, and I don't want to go into it.
Right. No problem. No,
that is my calibrations. Like when he first told me in 86,
Bob Carr told you,
in 86 about the anti-Krishnamurti. Now, they might have said something at a previous time, but I realized he'd been to India and he had all kinds of photos and stuff like that. And
yeah, that was in 79. He only meets UG Krishnamurti briefly in 66, and then he doesn't see him till 79 when he goes back to India, and that's when he really gets affected by him. And then you would see him in 86, because you hadn't seen him since the early 70s, since 73, when you saw him in 86. You had not seen him since 73.
Now, let's see. 73.
You know, from the October Israeli War period we went through the other day. You know, driving across America during
I'm trying to remember where Bob was at that time. Of course, he had the Retina Circus that was going full blast.
In 73, he's in San Francisco. We have it here. We'll get into that. He was actually doing a chemo. You remember Chemo, the TV station he was running, KEMO?
I went out there and saw the premiere production of Grand Funk Railroad, which he directed or something. It was a big studio, and they do it.
Yeah, they did the first, in the way he says they predicted and did MTV music videos, they did the sound, the Retina Circus,
right,
on TV.
Right, they did that up here.
Yeah.
And
they won
about
an Emmy.
70 with Quadraphonic Sound on Channel 7.
And he won an Emmy for it.
And then they got a contract from the city to do 10 performances with the... No, they got a contract to do one performance with the symphony in the Opera House. And it was so successful that they made a contract for them to do 10 more shows, and they bust in children from all over the city for those 10 more shows.
Yeah, he has a picture here, backstage at the Seattle Opera with Melton Katmus.
Melton, and I think the Joffrey Ballet did their premiere.
Right, and Melton Katmus, K-A-T-I-M-S.
Katmus.
Yeah, Katmus. Did you attend that? Did you see that?
No, I just knew about it.
Okay, the point is that you were saying, did you know that he won an Emmy for that TV show?
I think I heard so.
Okay. All right, so just to end this, and then we're going to get into some exciting things here. Well, it's been exciting all along, but now we're going to get into the crux of the matter about LSD.
All right, just a minute. I want to get a cigarette.
Okay.
I had a couple here that I smoked already, and I went to reach for another one. I thought, where is it? And then I had to come back in time and say, I've smoked it. Hold on.
Ending the chapter, and this chapter is called Swami Ram Dass, Servant of God, and he's just talking about wrapping up with Bharati. He says that he believed, Bob Carr believed that Krishnamurti was the man who broke away from every form of authority. And then he says, I did, though, enjoy Agaha. Or Agi.
Agi.
He's spelling it A-G-E-H-A. Agiha. But it's Agi, yeah. I did, though, enjoy Agi, as Connie and I used to call him. We spent many an evening kidding around with him. There were two persons in there. Leopold Fischer, who had grown up in Vienna, and also the man who later became Swami Agananda Bharati. Two people in there. You would agree with that, right?
At least.
At least. Okay, now, here's the neat part. We're going to get Chapter 6. Friday night was Flight Night. That's F-L-I-G-H-T. But Dave says it was Fright Night, named after the CIA guy, Elliot Craig.
Well, he's the one. The CIA guy is the one who used it from the very get-go.
Used the phrase.
Yeah. That was the phrase that was used. And I don't know where the Flight Night slipped in there. It could have been years later that he shifted it, but...
Right. Now...
Because I don't recall him ever using that phrase. It was always Friday Fright Night.
Right. So we... and everybody used that phrase, you know.
At the very outset, when we got contact with the guy...
Okay, before you go into that, Dave, I want to read, because this is what the first paragraph is. We'll get into this, but the thing is we don't have the details of your first trip on acid on tape, I don't think. We've discussed it different times, and you went into great detail when I had you talk to Mark Stallman last May, you know, a couple months ago.
But that wasn't recorded.
That wasn't recorded. So I don't know how much we're going to go into it, but I think this paragraph will trigger a lot of statements from me. Here's what he says. I had read the little book, The Doors of Perception, by Aldous Huxley.
And I'm the one who did.
He's saying he did. See?
That was the trigger that got me there, and he didn't see it till later.
That's interesting. Okay, so here is...
But he's jumping over, and he's including the trigger.
That's right.
But it was for me, not for him.
Okay. I don't think... We're going to spend a lot of time trying to get through this paragraph, Dave.
Well, I've spent a long time getting through this life.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's between parentheses, and I don't know when the other part's coming up.
That's right. I had read the little book, The Doors of Perception, by Aldous Huxley, and found it very thought-provoking. The central idea in it was that mystics in both Eastern and Western culture could alter their consciousness by intense meditation and sensory isolation. Or, in the case of the Hindu Aryans, they drank the sacred soma juice that quickly altered their minds, creating all kinds of strange experiences. In their visions, gods and goddesses played out mythic stories that told of the journey of mortal man trying to become a godlike being who could rule the Hindu cosmos.
Is he quoting from Huxley?
No, that's him writing. That's him.
Well, he didn't put it as quotes?
No. No, he's just summarizing the central idea of the book. Of The Doors of Perception.
In other words, he's using that as poetic license to pull in a lot of other stuff that he's eventually found out and putting it right back in there. That's all right for the storytelling.
Yeah. So in their visions, the Soma visions, gods and goddesses played out mythic stories that told of the journey of mortal man trying to become a godlike being who could rule the Hindu cosmos. The Aztecs ground the seeds of the morning glory flower and used the paste as a sacrament. They ingested the paste, and that granted them for some hours a world where the senses were stripped clean and one experienced the great mysteries of life. Ancient people all over the world have long known of the chemical powers of some plants. So that's his summary of The Doors of Perception. Then he
yeah.
did. Yeah.
Then what does he say?
It was 1957, and in one of my many trips to Vancouver, B.C., I made the acquaintance of a psychologist who was...
He jumped right over that. Is that like the thing that happened is...
Well, no,
the CIA agent reported...
Right, Dave, we're going to go into your correction. Let me just...
Yeah, I know. Okay, but the point is, it was that the psychologist came down in his Rolls Royce to see me at the center.
Right, he's going to jump over what actually happened. So let me just finish it, and then you take all the time to explain what actually happened. He goes... It was 1957, and in one of my many trips to Vancouver, B.C., I made the acquaintance of a psychologist who was experimenting with new psychotropic drugs, using them to treat patients for a variety of disorders and substance abuse. He found that many of his patients had a variety of mystical-like experiences, and the effects gave the subjects some insight into the source or cause of their problems. Some recovered from their addictions and changed their lives to a degree.
Not at that time. In other words, in 1957, they were looking. They had done very little, and they came to me to get the answers that they were looking for, and they got them, and that is what then could be stated. In other words, if Bob took a trip up there 6 months after we started, and they said all of that, well, then that would be true.
But
he didn't even know any of that.
Okay, so he says, some recovered from their addictions and changed their lives to a degree. My new friend, and he's talking about, we assume, Captain Hubbard, right? A.M. Hubbard, that's who I think he means by the psychologist.
Well, he's implying that.
Yeah. My new friend suggested that I get in touch with... No, Dave, you relax, this is going to blow you out. My new friend suggested that I get in touch with the Swiss pharmaceutical company Sandoz. After spending many hours with my friend, my mind was changed in regard to taking a drug that could alter one's mind. Perhaps one might experience a mystical state of consciousness. I decided that I must put it to the test and find out for myself. When I returned to Seattle, I told Connie of my meeting with the psychologist, and we both decided to contact Sandoz Laboratories and order lysergic acid diethylamide.
There's so many zigzags there. You want me to go through them?
Well, let me just finish this paragraph, then you can do it. When we called Sandoz, they said they would send 100 milligrams with some paperwork to fill out. In a few days, a little package arrived containing the LSD. The prescribed amount was 100 micrograms per dose. My friend in Vancouver had told me, quote, take 200 micrograms and some orange juice, make yourself comfortable, listen to some music and explore your mind if you can find it, or lose it and float in the sea of consciousness, unquote.
See, he's just jumping all over kinds of all
That's
kinds
right,
of stuff.
Yeah, and I've heard this so many times from you that I know I could recognize this. That's why I'm looking forward to your correction. Anyways, and get it on tape. Connie had invited his sister and a friend of hers, Isabel. There's Isabel.
Yeah.
That's correct, right? Well, at least
that was
them.
Later, but go ahead.
Yeah, who also attended the center. Another friend of hers, Mark, joined us also. Do you remember Mark?
A friend of theirs, Mark.
Of Isabel. A friend of Isabel.
Well, I think she had a son named Mark.
Okay. And at about 8 o'clock in the evening, the five of us took our doses mixed in orange juice and set sail for an unknown journey into the unconscious. I'm going to read the next paragraph because I know that you are going to fill in a lot. And even about when he first took it. So here's how he presents.
Well, I think it's that's all junk.
Right. Now let me just give you the final junk paragraph about how he describes what happened to him on this first trip. In the past, I journeyed into that vast sea, but not to this degree. In a few minutes, I could feel the changes in my perception, along with a feeling of release and a sense that I was no longer in control of my thoughts. Connie looked at me with a smile on his face and said, quote, "You can have it any way you want."
All right. I got something to say about that.
Well, we'll get to that, okay? Because we're going to do it in chronological order, I hope. He says, "I just relaxed and surrendered to every moment. There was no place to land. For the next 4 hours, we traveled through time and experienced the vast ocean of life and its creative movement. I was sure this was the most fantastic experience of my life. I saw that my question, quote, what are the states that mystics describe, unquote, was now answered by my own introspection and an experience of what consciousness is. I could see that all those states described by the saints and teachers were part of the vast collective memories of mankind. Just how and where these memories exist, whether they exist in the brain cells or whether the brain is a reactor to a mental sphere, I could not say. The ancient wisdom of India claims that there is a subtle mental plane that penetrates the physical. However, people who take LSD or psilocybin undergo all kinds of experiences that are outside their own personal memories. Shamans all over the world describe events and places that are outside of their known experiences. There is no question that the brain can create any kind of experience. In other words, there is no experience outside the mind. If there is no mind or thought, there is no sense of you, a center that creates an image of the world to experience. I'll read that last sentence again. If there is no mind or thought, there is no sense of you, meaning a center that creates an image of the world to experience. Then he says this, Dave, and this is the last part. That night I went crazy. I lost my reference point to everything. I was creating my world picture, and that gave me the realization that I was just a reaction and not separate from creation, just pure, simple consciousness. I would never be the same again. That experience opened the doors of perception for me and gave me a new view of reality. So, let's hear what really happened.
Well, going back to which point? Let's see. In the first place, I already said,
go into the theater and talk.
Well, maybe I should tell you about my first acid session and then move it through to why it was significant to them.
Yes, but let's begin with the spring before 57, when Vern goes to Everett and comes back and opens the restaurant and that Paramount guy.
Yeah. Well, what happened is it was a French restaurant, and it was in the Paramount Theater building. And Cinerama was performing there, you know, the triple screen, triple projector thing. And they had to have a producer in every facility. And the producer was in the basement of the Paramount Theater at an office.
What street is Paramount Theater on in Seattle?
Pine Street.
Okay. And you're living at the center at this time that you're describing.
I think so, because of other things. Anyway, so
the restaurant was at...
this producer would come to eat in the restaurant.
Which was right beside the building where he worked.
It was inside the building. It was the fronted out on Pine, but it was part of the Paramount Theater building.
And he worked, you're saying, in the basement, his office.
His office, he had a big office in the basement, and so we were the closest restaurant, and he came to eat there.
What was his name?
Egan Rank.
Egan Rank. Would he be the Rank? Wasn't that the British film company or production was Rank?
I think it was the same, because this guy was a big wheel in MGM. Whether he was the same guy or... a relative, I don't know,
right.
But he, I really don't know that you, now that you mention it, because there is a Rank Productions in England, but I can't remember what time factor either, whether it's before, during, or after.
No, it was before, I can look that up, that was in the 30s and 40s, I think.
Well, maybe I've slipped a cog, maybe it wasn't Egan. Maybe I connected with that. We're looking at my mind now to see whether I connected the Egan Rank
Okay, here's what it is. The Rank Organization was a British entertainment company formed in 1937.
By?
J. Arthur Rank.
J. Arthur. Okay, then it was Egan. Egan Rank. Is so I'm correct.
Yes.
That's a thrill, because it was a jolt to come up with that thing to question.
Yeah.
And it released, I mean, I thought I was going to release a lot of negative energy, but I didn't. I found out how positive it was, and it gave me a spurt. Oh, nice experience. I enjoy this tonight.
Good. Okay.
So far.
So Egan Rank would come to your restaurant, which was in the same building.
Yes, in the Paramount Theater building.
And the restaurant was created by Cecil and Vern, known as Chris also.
Cecil Keeney and Vern Christensen, also called Chris.
His original name was Chris, right?
His original name was Laverne Harold Christensen.
Oh.
Christensen, E-N-S-O-N. But he liked to be called Vern. And then when he started singing...
In Hollywood in the early 50s.
Well, he was singing around the Northwest, too, and then he went in the Army, and he went to Hollywood. It's, anyway, in his professional capacity, eventually he called himself Chris. And people seemed to call him Chris, and so he accepted it and started calling himself Chris.
Okay, and that was in 50, 51, 52 in L.A., right?
Yeah, I would start in 49 in Seattle.
Right, but you were with him in L.A.,
yeah, and 49 and 50. By late 50, he got drafted, and then in 51, well, he was sent to Texas, and I followed him to Texas, and then from Texas, he was sent to Baltimore, and I followed him back to Baltimore. I was a camp follower.
Yes. And that's in 50, 51, 52, you're saying?
And then 51, from 51, I started working at John L. Martin. And
Where was that?
In Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
Essex, Maryland, John L. Martin Airplanes. And that's where I did the missile trip.
Right.
You know, which we've got that down on tape, haven't we?
Maybe not. I think it might be on the other tape. But let's just stay with the LSD. We're just giving a little background. And Vern is an important person, and he was a good singer, right?
The best. But the problem he had, which took a long time for us to actually psych out, is that when he would perform, he would go into trance. He didn't know what called it, but that's what it winds up that he was doing with. He would perform and go into trance, and it would be an incredible experience. And people would applaud, and when they would applaud, it would shatter him, and he couldn't handle it. And he couldn't handle, you know, when he got into that stage, he couldn't handle the cigarette smoke. He liked to smoke, he liked to drink, but he couldn't handle it in a crowd of people. So that kind of made it a blockage or a thing for him to overcome or not be able to overcome. It was something he always wanted to do, and I think if in some way he had been able to get a good recording out and get it so that that was the feature, and he could sit back and let it be experienced, then he might have been able to come out on top of it and have a notion. I had a friend who says, you know what he'd have been? He'd have been like another Frank Sinatra, because of his nature. He would have been terribly hard to control and would have gotten too wild into everything. And I said, don't mention it, please. Yeah.
Okay, so here's Vern and Cecil form this restaurant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Café Entre Deux, which was between two gay bars. I mean, actually, a block away was a gay bar, and about a block away the other direction was a gay bar. And here was a theater building, and so people traveling back and forth between the gay bars certainly noticed the French restaurant.
Now, in Seattle, citizenry in the 50s, was it well known there were gay bars, or was it under...
Oh, yeah. There were quite a few in town. There, you know, it was like a... there's quite a story about all kinds of strata of gayness. You know, it's like the Saturday night, late night shop was under the double header. The double header was like a beer bar during the day, but gay bar at night. And then on the weekends, we would have Miss Peabody's Dance, which actually was the name for the downstairs where they had lots of room for maybe 400 or 500 people to go down and dance. And there was, you know, you would bring your drinks, after hours club.
That was near where you're talking about?
It was right under Doubleheader.
It was beside the restaurant, you're saying?
No, that was down, no. Okay. It was, that was down in Pioneer Square area, you know, the near Skid Road.
Right. Now you're talking.
But the reason I'm bringing it up is that the property was owned by the chief of police, and he sanctioned everything.
Which property?
The property that the doubleheader was in, and the Miss Peabody's downstairs, which really was a big pool hall for about 12 tables and lots of extra space.
But it was near the poor part of town.
Well, supposedly, you know, but it was also only a block from the police station.
Okay, so the the Cafe Entre Nous,
that was uptown, and there were two gay bars up there. But I was saying there's many different other gay bars.
Yeah.
That I just.
But Entre Nous is ENTRE.
Yeah, it means between us.
Yeah, NOUS, Cafe Entre Nous.
Yeah, between us, and the kind of. The between us was between the two gay bars.
Yes.
And it was between us, you know.
Did they name it because of that? Is that the
huh?
Was that the meaning of the name? It was
Yes.
Between us, the gay world. Between us.
Between two gay bars, and also it was a denotation that we're accepting of gay people too.
Yeah. Okay, so this guy comes in and knows, and you're not working there, but you did something there.
Yeah, well, I am working there, because I'd remodeled the place, and I'd had, when Cecil left, nobody to pay the bills. I paid the bills and became a partner.
Well, how did you pay the bills? Where'd you get your money to pay the bills?
Well, at that time, I was working, I had money, but I had been working at,
that'd be the place.
Engineers.
Graham? Which one is?
No, this was.
It's actually in.
This was after Graham.
Yeah, it's in the Paranoia magazine.
Pacific Engineers, I think it was called. This is the one where the partners had a lawsuit against each other and closed down for 3 weeks, and everybody had 3 weeks off, and during that time is when we remodeled the restaurant, because I had the time, and I put up. Thing I put up the money and then they were supposed to pay me, but then I became a partner. But anyway, I was back in the booth, one of the booths, with some books about parapsychology from the center. When he saw them, and he says, "Oh, I've got a book I want you to read," and he brought me The Doors of Perception. And then after I had read it, he says, "I would like to invite you to a party on Friday."
How long did it take you to read it? A week?
Oh, no, a day.
Oh, okay.
It's a little book, and I was very interested. So anyway...
I want to just interrupt here and ask you one thing. What are you doing in the restaurant? Your money is supporting it, but are you doing some job?
Well, yeah, I do it. I'm doing everything. I was a jack of all trades. I was doing the books. I was doing the cashier. I was waiting.
And you were able.
I was a maitre d' type thing, and
you were able to do this because there was a strike at work. I mean, you were off work for a few weeks,
and I was working 14 hours a day.
Right, and you could actually go into the microfilm of the Seattle Times, find out when that was announced in the newspaper, and know exactly the day this is going on. right?
Probably. I know that we advertised in the newspaper out of Washington, University of Washington. We had a little ad. I had myself or my other actions in relation to the gallery that was certainly in the Times, but that was later.
Okay, so anyway, so he gives you the book, and in a day you read it, and then in a few days later it's Friday.
Yes. I think it was only a couple of days till... I think he gave me the book, and the next day he probably asked me if I wanted to go to a party on Friday, which was... And I said, well, I'll arrange things, and so I did, so I could leave, because...
Hey, you know what? I just got a little pattern. This is... Let's assume this is March 57. That's when McLuhan's guru, Wyndham Lewis, dies. In March 57, right when you're taking acid. So this is just a little connection I made in my head.
Oh, well, click, click.
Yeah, and
or shall I say thrill, thrill.
No, and Wyndham Lewis was a great precursor of all this stuff.
What's his name?
Wyndham Lewis, L-E-W.
Oh, Wyndham. Wyndham Lewis. Yeah. I think I have heard.
I've mentioned him to you.
Yeah, well, the Wyndham part I didn't quite get, but I do.
But he died in March 57, and it looks like this is about March 57 when this Friday is happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And people,
so anyway,
people got to realize this is the real acid. This is not, you know, Owsley molecule added acid. This is Sandoz.
Well, I mean, Sandoz had an extra molecule that made it 50 times as strong as street acid. Owsley had an extra molecule, but it was a different one, which was 50 times as strong as street acid. If you took the two of them together, they were 250 times as strong as street acid. But when we got together and talked about it, said, hell, it's off the board, and we must be 5,000 times as strong, you know.
You mean when you did both of them?
Yeah, but I...
And you did
I didn't
do that.
Fool
you
around
did,
with
did you
it.
Do both at the same time?
I didn't fool around with it. We had a point in 66 where these guys came and wanted to have me handle 10 million doses of Owsley. There were only five people between them and the source, but they wanted me to be the handler of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought about it for a few minutes and realized how much energy was involved, and I didn't want to do it. So I didn't do it, and then... the following October was when it was made totally illegal. Up to that time,
October 66, so it's the same period. Same,
yeah.
But
this was like probably in
February 66.
Still July
early
summer or something.
A few months before.
But okay. They brought me some, and that's the acid I was on when I saw Krishnamurti down there in October.
Oh, yeah, so you did do some Owsley.
Yeah.
That time.
But not the two together, I'm sure,
right.
That I recall.
Okay, but back to, so this Cecil guy, did you know him well?
Yes. When I met Chris was staying with Cecil in an apartment on Capitol Hill, and that's where we went, and Cecil was there, and so for... And then, of course,
wait,
they
did
wanted,
you say when you met Chris?
Yes.
1949, you met sorry, I got mixed up. I meant Rank.
Egan Rank, okay.
Cecil is someone that you knew for many years before, and you met him because he was a roommate. Were they lovers, Vern and...
No, he was much older, and I don't think so.
Okay, so anyway, but Egan Rank, did you know him well? When he approached,
we got to know each other quite well.
But not when he saw you reading the literature, you didn't know him.
Only as a customer that,
right.
that came in and that you greeted and et cetera. And then he saw the books, and that started the dialogue. And then he brought me the book.
Right, and you're reading those books as part of your search to figure out what the heck happened at the haunted house. Right?
Still, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, because you have some fantastic figure. You studied 3,000 metaphysicians and things through that period. You read a lot, right?
Yeah, and then of course in the days at the center, there was about between all the stuff that came and went, and afterwards, I figure that I studied about 3,000 psychics and their trip before I went into awareness. It's like that the 5% that weren't traumatized were clearer, and therefore that was probably my first connection with awareness. But so that's down the line. I mean, there obviously was all kinds of awareness in the LSD sessions and et cetera.
Yeah.
But as far as the progressive method of discovery, even through all of that, the coming to awareness was another step. Now, of course, if one took acid and looked into awareness, then that would be different. But I didn't have that to start with. I had that to wind up with.
You had acid to wind up with?
Well, I had awareness to wind up with after all the acid experiences and then the other stuff. And it even went beyond what had been. Now, you might say then it went up. But during the time when all that acid was going on, you have to consider it's like horizontal. That the whole process, for instance, the CIA agent that wanted me to go into a state later so I would travel astrally.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what he was talking about. And this is like in 1962, about 2 years after we'd closed the center.
Yeah.
And
that was was that Elliot Craig or Stan Carlin?
Elliot Craig, and that was in San Francisco. Anyway, I thought that he was putting me on when he talked about the Cuban crisis, and he said, "That's why I had you take the acid so you'd look at it." And I said, "What do you mean look at it?" He says, "I want you to travel." I said, "What do you mean travel?" He says, "Well, you do, you know." And I said, "No." He said, "Oh, my God, in every session I ever saw, you travel all over the place. I can't do it, but I can follow." He said, "I thought you knew what you were doing all that time." And so apparently I was traveling. I do know the reference to being in many, many, many people's acid sessions in many, many odd places that I never went to that I recall, except apparently astrally projecting on acid and tripping with whatever was happening. So that's a whole psychodrama of the mind that I haven't been able to really get my hands on exactly.
Well, maybe
the fact that it apparently happened, once in a while I'll glance at it and I think, well, I don't know.
Maybe we'll find something in these talks here. So, but Egan Rank is a customer, and he sees you, and when you say you looked into 3,000 psychics, you mean you read stuff, or you saw people pass through the center?
Like checking them out, interviewing them, asking questions, and finding that they could only go so far before their own trauma started coming out.
Right, but how are you getting access? Are these people visiting center, or are you traveling around?
I guess it's at the center that I have to pull in there, because although there was probably a few years after that there was that same kind of thing going on, so it might not have all been in that three-year period. It might have been stretched over a longer period of time.
Okay.
And beyond, and the acid stopped for me in 60 pretty much for quite a while. And so the other would not have been on, you know, but I was capable of looking deeply into things.
Okay, so Egan Rank says, come to this party. So after work, you hop in the car.
We ride in his car, and we travel this road that goes out. It turns out it was just around the corner from the place where you came and visited me in Richmond Beach.
Yeah, in 69.
Yeah, but this would have been in 1957, and there was this house that had a double garage that had been turned into like a playroom, and had all kinds of posters and lighting and et cetera. The woman whose house it was an interior designer.
Had posters? Did you say?
Oh, yeah, all kinds of posters, but nothing like came out, but it was like some interesting art posters.
Yeah.
That she had put in there as an interior designer. And there's a doctor and a lawyer and a banker, an interior designer, and Egan Rank, and myself, and Elliot Craig. So I guess there were seven of us there. That sounds right to me. And anyway, they give me, on the way to the place, 15 minutes before we get there is when I found out that I have the chance to take LSD, but I don't have to. Is something going on? I heard some clicks.
Yeah, I'm just switching phones. My
All right,
going
okay.
Down. So you're saying that, yeah, I think you've told me this a bit before. What is he saying to you in the car? You don't even know what he's setting up for you.
Well, he says, you know that book that you read, we're going to this place, and we're going to have a chance to take LSD-25. He says, have you heard about it? I said, I think I heard about it in one article I saw at the center, but it didn't say much.
Yeah, they don't. LSD-25 is not in the Doors of Perception.
No, yeah. But there may have been some kind of a brochure or information or something that I saw at the center in passing. So
I would say if that's true,
LSD-25 was not a new word to me totally.
Yeah, now if there was something about LSD at the center, then it might mean that Robert brought that in and then he did get it from the psychologist. Just throw in a devil's advocate little twist here.
Never happened.
Well, why would there be something there since nobody there knew at the center knew about it?
There are publications and magazines and et cetera and
right.
Stuff like that. It was that sort of thing.
I see. So somebody was, yeah, you don't know who in that center read it, but you saw it, you think.
Well, I think I saw it, so when he said it, who knows, maybe I read it in some other paper someplace else.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it seems that when he said LSD-25, I knew what it meant, that it was lysergic acid, diethylamide, or whatever it is.
And that it would alter consciousness. You had an idea that's what
Well, I don't know whether I knew that much about it.
Okay.
But you see, I'd only just been given the book about mescaline, and he's telling me that the LSD is similar.
Had you heard about mescaline and that before you read Doors of Perception?
No, I hadn't.
Yeah, it was all new to you, this idea.
Oh, yeah. And the only thing is, as I was making my mind up, when I was reading The Doors of Perception, I thought of the haunted house enough.
Yeah.
So when he, on this drive out, he said LSD, and I thought, I wonder if this will give me a clue on what happened to me in the haunted house.
Yeah.
And so when I take it, and it turns me on, of course, it visited all those areas, except it was a completely different phenomena. That other one was a constant shock every 10 seconds of 10,000 volts for 36 hours. And that isn't, I didn't repeat that. It's like I kind of repeated the aftermath of that.
Yeah, the heightened state, the aftermath.
Yeah. So anyway.
You walk into the room and how do they introduce it to you? How do they? Is it an orange juice?
I think it was some kind of juice. It seems like it was a little cocktail glass, like an old fashioned that had some juice in it, and I drank it.
Are they?
It was red juice.
Right, but are they waiting for you to show up? Is there a little chit chat before this happens?
Actually, when we arrived, everybody's all kind of assembled around and they smile and there's kind of introductions, you know.
Yeah.
And then right away he about the time the introductions are through, Craig handed me the glass. He says, "You know what this is?" And I said, "Well, I've heard the story about something." He says, "Well, do you want to partake?" I said, "Well, because of an experience I had, I'm going to try it."
And so
he smiled, and I took it. And
okay, that's Elliot. It's a Craig Elliot. Elliot Craig is his name. Okay, that he's using. What was the other name he might have been? David?
David Street, I think.
He was another name.
I hope this doesn't get anybody into trouble, but I don't think so.
Right. Now, you don't know he's CIA at this point.
I don't have any idea of whether he's alive. Because
I mean, back then, you don't know he's CIA in March 57. You do not know who these people are.
Let's see. No, I don't think I know till maybe a day later.
Oh, okay. So it's Elliot, and can you name the other people? You said what they did, a doctor?
No, as far as their... I think Philip Royal, who worked with Egan Rank in the theater, was there. So that may be eight. There may have been seven of us plus the eighth guy who gave it to us.
And that's Elliot. But
as far as the names of the others, I don't recall. It was...
Did the woman take the acid, the homeowner?
Oh, yes, yes. It turns out she was... She was married to an executive at MGM who worked with Egan Rank, but they were getting a divorce, and she was Elliot's mistress.
Right, so it's Elliot, her, Egan, and you, and then you. Who were the other people? Just a doctor, did you say? A lawyer?
It was a doctor, a lawyer, a banker.
Three people, and then Philip Royal.
Yeah, he was like a... Well, like an assistant manager or something, or the manager in the theater. Maybe he was the manager in the theater, but Egan was the producer of Cinerama, so it's like he had the hammer, and Philip
held the nail.
Huh?
He held the nail. Yeah. But here's what's interesting: they're all upper middle class or professional people that would be linked into an elite and CIA people, maybe, and are they in touch with Hubbard? He had to get the acid from Hubbard, right?
Well, the thing is, it came through Collins.
Stanley Collins?
And I, at one time, had a lineage from Hubbard to two or three other people, and maybe four or five before it got to Collins, and then from Collins it went to Craig. From Craig it went to me, and from me it went to Chris, and it went to Carr and Conrad, and then Doobie. And then there were others. But I'm giving the line.
Yes, of how it...
So it's sort of like if you wanted something, you contacted the one up the line.
Right, but you've said that...
Some of them, sometimes they jumped. I could jump the line, but that was a separate, different thing because of our relationship on lots of other levels, which was more to do with therapy and the process than it was to the substance that was taken.
Right, but Hubbard is the choke point, the controller of any LSD.
Well, he had total control of all Sandoz in North and South America, including what went to all governments. No government got anything from Sandoz. It had to come through him.
Yeah, A.M. Hubbard.
Yeah.
H-U-B-B-A-R-D, not L. Ron Hubbard. Okay, so you take the acid, and let's hear a little description of what happened.
Okay, well, the first thing is they'd given me one of those little triangles of cheese that's in foil.
Yeah.
And I was standing there trying to unpeel it. And,
yeah,
of course, with the music that was going, I was swaying and using this. And at a certain point, I was doing pretty good, but I had to stop for a minute to get a little extra hold on a fold of that foil over the cheese, you know.
I used to have that all the time.
Anyway, when I stopped to do that, there was people sitting over on the side of the thing saying, "Don't stop, don't stop, don't stop." There was about three of them. And I looked at them, and I kept kind of like dancing. And then I saw that I had a show going, and so then I performed. And then I just did the same thing, except now I was aware of being watched, and I was aware of what I was doing on a whole different level. And that was really fun. And then all of a sudden, I had this pause, and there was these drapes and a door slightly open, and the wind was moving the drapes. Well, I was watching these drapes, and all of a sudden, through the door came this about 3 foot in diameter feathered serpent that came and swirled, peaked and swirled around the world, the room, and went out. It was like a feather boa that was 50 feet long and 3 feet in diameter, and it was just moving through there. And of course, they called it the great feathered serpent, but eventually.
But the thing is, many people have seen that snake, so to speak, on acid. No, would you agree that was a common image that came up?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, several people.
I've heard of it after, but I didn't know that then at all.
Yeah, you didn't know that then. But
no, I saw the real thing.
Right, but you've heard of that later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh. Anyway, right after that, he had 3 hula hoops of 3 different colors spinning on his arm at 3 different speeds.
That's great.
And there was
Craig.
Elliot
Craig is doing this. He's spinning.
And there's a light wheel, colored wheel, that's shining on it so that in the intricate detail of which you can see is every single one of these colors and every one of the color changes and all the different speeds and etc. And I thought, my God, what a wonderful hypnotic apparatus. And so I started to study it as someone who knew hypnosis, and that this, I thought, oh, this would be remarkable. And that's when he said, "Do you see any monsters in there?" And I looked at him right straight in the eyes, and I said, "Not unless they're yours." And he just took those and threw them, and all 3 of those
hula hoops
were bouncing off the wall from every direction, and he was laying down on his back on the floor, stamping his feet and laughing like a madman. And that's when he got up from that, then he says, "You know, I think I've got to show you some things." So he started showing me all kinds of things, apparently, that he learned, in some cases he had learned so far, but then he was wondering, and I would say, "Well, what about this?" And he'd look at me, and it would take it higher. And this happened about 20 times in the night, and that's why he contacted Hubbard.
Because of how you were reacting. You
well, know. Because of actually many of the things had to do with Krishnamurti. In other words, my ability to look at things this way was like, right out of Krishnamurti. I hadn't really studied that much, but I was operating in it.
You were channeling a level of awareness like Krishnamurti advocated naturally in that situation.
I guess, but I didn't know that. All I knew is they were telling me what they'd learned, and then I would say, "Well, what about this?" And apparently each of these, "What about this?" blew their minds. And that's when Hubbard came down
a couple days later, right?
Let's see. I think the next day after that, or maybe it took a day's delay, Bob and Connie had their session. And in
the next day, they had their session? That soon?
Yeah, it might have been 2 days, but a day or two.
Okay, so you went back to the center and told them what had happened to you.
Yes, and they decided, and then I called, and it was just whatever time it took to arrange it, they had a session.
Did they do it before Vern?
I'm trying to remember, because Vern and I and Elliot were out in the motel. Where we took a session, and I can't remember. It's possible that it was on the day in between, and then Bob and Connie, or it could have been the day after. But it was all in the same ballpark.
Well,
I always
get
put.
Go ahead.
Always put Chris as right behind me in line.
Right. But how do you get the acid to Bob and Connie? Did Ellie give you some? Or did he come over?
No, they went to a Friday Fright Night.
Somewhere else, not at the center.
And not at the house that I was in out in the north. It was somewhere in Ballard.
Well, that if it's Friday, it has to be the next week, 7 days later. Because you did the acid on a Friday.
Well, there might have been an exception in there that after that there was a routine that every Friday they did have a planned session someplace, and they called it Friday Fright Night. Now there were other sessions in between, I think.
Right. So,
but the Friday Fright Night was almost like a gathering, whereas the sessions might be only one or two or three, and it was a different kind of a thing. It was looser. On the Friday Fright Night, but it was still had a strong structure. We didn't call it recreational for a long time. We finally had a recreational session, and that's the one where we were all sitting in the dining room, and I looked around, and there was five of us, and they all had my face. And they are all having the same experience. They were seeing their own face on everybody. So even, and we were all seeing our own face on everybody there.
Mm.
And that was really something.
And then in retrospect, it was called recreational? That's
well, I would call that, in other words, what people call recreational. See, everything else was therapy.
Yeah.
I mean, the high points and et cetera might, in a sense, be quasi-recreational, but it wasn't taken with the notion of recreation, so to speak.
We
were all doing therapy.
Right, but the recreational aspect seems to come in when everybody had this weird experience of seeing their own face and everything.
Yeah, that was not therapy we were all therapists, but we weren't having therapy we were just having the experience, and then we had that, once we had that experience, it really made a difference in relationships all across the board.
And that was about a year later after your first?
No. It was, I don't think it was maybe 5 weeks or five, oh. No more than 5 months. No, I think it was about 5 weeks before we had our first recreational.
Right.
Then after that, on the recreational thing, we wanted to only do it in nature. In the meantime,
yeah.
All this other stuff had been in therapy, enclosed, and, you know, people didn't run around.
Right.
Except for the first session with, I forgot to tell you about Bob when he...
Right. Now, let me ask you this. You go to where Bob gets the acid. You went along. You went to where Bob and Connie had the first trip.
Oh, no, I wasn't there. I just heard about it from Connie.
And this is what you're going to tell us now, what happened to them.
Because Bob wasn't going to talk about it much. He did once in a while, just for a moment. But what happened is that Bob freaked out, and he believed that Elliot was the devil. and devilish Elliot practically performed for him. You know.
Yeah, he got into it.
you think I'm the devil? You know. Anyway, Bob freaked out and started running down the street. This is late at night. And so Elliot signals to Connie just to cool it, and Connie sits there and cools it. And so he runs after him, but he only runs for a little ways. And then he said, "Where you going, Bob?" and he stops. And he said, "Well, where are you going?" And he can't figure out. He says, "Do you want to go this way?" And he says, "I don't." It's like, I think he said one time, "I didn't want to go with the devil." But I didn't have anywhere to go. So he went back. They got him back in the house. And that's when Connie said, just what he says. Connie
in the
said,
report, yeah,
and that he didn't, he just signaled him. It's, you know,
I'll read it.
What is the phrase that's in there? Is exactly what I heard before.
Right. And what's interesting is that when we discussed earlier about how you people would not use much verbality on when you were stoned, and you would just look at each other's faces and make little ESP gestures and winks and things. That's what I get from this sentence, because he goes, "Connie looked at me with a smile on his face." But, okay, he didn't know he wasn't supposed to say anything, so that doesn't apply. You know what I mean when I'm saying?
But that was like an extremely early learning experience.
Yeah.
And the indication he was going is it depends on how you do it.
Connie looked at me with a smile on his face, so then I spin off on the way you guys would not be verbal, and that's not relevant to this situation because it's the first time. Connie looked at me with a smile on his face and said, violating the rules that were later developed of not to say anything, right? You know what I mean? That's what I'm going on about here. Connie looked at me with a smile on his face and said, quote, "You can have it any way you want."
But he also used his hands moving up up and down and side and side. It's like
he did a haptic move with his hands?
Well, it's like if you put your hands right out straight in front of you and you tip them to the right and to the left, and then you play back and forth.
Yeah.
It was that kind of a move.
Yeah, it's like when you bounce, you wiggle your wrist. And you go, "Well, I can go this way or that way." You can have it any way you want. Tilt your wrist that way, tilt it the other way, right?
Yeah.
That kind of gesture.
Yes, and forces and energies and et cetera.
Yeah, so you're saying that, so here's Bob conflating all this thing, because he does say, he says, "You can have it any way you want," he reports Connie, but it's later he says, next paragraph, "That night I went crazy." See, he does it in the wrong order. First he went crazy, then
I know, that's why I laughed so hard.
Yeah. Then Connie,
he has to get it in there because it's true, but he doesn't want to put it in. Well, anyway, I'm not going to project that. But anyway, there was like either a rug or some linoleum or some kind of a pattern that was right there in front of when
Connie
Bob,
did that. When Connie
Connie was sitting, and then Bob sat down beside him, and Connie started looking at it, and Bob started looking at it too, so they were looking at it, and then, of course, the whole mandala came up, you know.
Is this after? Is this after he says you can have it any way you want, or in the middle?
Yeah, and after they were looking at it together, and then it's like the mandala, the whole kind of thing that you see in fractal. Trip like that occurred, and that's when he lost his place. And I knew that I'd lost my place, and thought, well, okay. And then later I found that I came back in the spot. So after that I found, oh, I don't have to keep track of my place because it does it. I can just leave and go into it, and then when I come back, that's where I come back in.
Right, but are you saying that, see, when they see the mandala, is that after Connie has said you can have it any way you want?
Right, I think so.
So they see the mandala, and so what happens next? Okay, they're seeing the mandala, and what happens?
I'm sure that they got in connection with all their spiritual teachings, because there's mandalas and stuff that's presented in that.
Yeah.
So whatever he saw from his own consciousness, based on what he knew of, was probably profound.
Yeah.
I don't really know, except it made the difference. But it's that first jolt through that he, in some ways, he doesn't like to remember that first session because of what was involved in the start of it. And in a way, it was the most perfect thing for him, whether he knew it or not.
Elaborate. How was it perfect for his psychology?
Well, you've seen all the descriptions of what he was talking about, where he came from, what he was doing, and et cetera.
Yeah.
And, of course, the magician's gaff, and what's the gaff on this? You had a question like that on acid.
Yeah, yeah.
You really get the shaft of the gaff.
Yes. And so... you're hearing Connie report this after.
Yeah.
And what did they say about the whole experience in summer?
Bob was trying to stop him from talking about, don't talk about that, et cetera, especially if it got anywhere near the thing about him being the devil.
Right. He's the guru. It's not cool the guru was running down the street.
And it's not... and then he had nothing to do but follow the devil back home.
Yeah, resist
and then it shifted.
Yeah,
but,
resist not evil, Dave. You follow the devil back home.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I as I said, for his therapy, that was outstanding.
He said it was a great experience.
Yes, but he doesn't say...
He said, that night I went crazy. I lost my reference point to everything. Now, you're saying you lose your reference point when you're looking at the mandala, and then you flip out, but then you get hip to the fact you'll come back. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's something that people discover.
Right, later.
A few people I told that, but it didn't make any difference. It's mostly...
And he's saying, I lost my reference point, is in reference to going crazy. And then he says, I was creating my world picture. That would have been the mandala.
Yeah.
And that gave me the realization that I was just a reaction and not separate from creation, just pure, simple consciousness. I would never be the same again. That experience opened the doors of perception for me and gave me a new view of reality.
Yes. So he brings it right back around to the doors of perception.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for writing, it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, so we have to end it there. It's 10 o'clock.
Okay, now let me see.
Do you want to say a little bit more about, wrap up this Connie LSD trip, or what happened the next couple of days? A.M. Hubbard comes, Albert Hubbard comes.
Okay, yeah.
It's after. Does he come after Connie and Bob's trip?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It was from the time... Elliot Craig told through the line to them. In other words, I don't know whether he said anything to him.
To who?
To Hubbard. Until, I don't think he did, after the first session with me, I don't think he called him right now and says, I've got it. I think what happened is the other few sessions happened, and then... because of the connection with the center. You see, I was the president, but he didn't know what that was. But when he did it with Bob and Connie, and then he saw what the center was, and then from there he called Hubbard, and then Hubbard came down to talk to me, and when he came to talk to me, the first part of the meeting, we talked together. And then at a certain point, as he started to present the proposal, I said, oh, now, wait a minute. And that's when I got Bob and Connie to come in. And then he did the proposal for all of us. And
how did he state that proposal? Was it, okay, I can...
Well, basically, he told the history of what research they'd done, the different...
alcoholics and schizophrenics.
Yes, as well as other psychiatrists and stuff. And he said that they had tried to work with some groups, but every group that they gave it to shattered. And so they weren't going to try that anymore. But when they came across me and them and the center, and we were a paranormal group to start with. He thought there might be something that could work because there were paranormal interests to start with. And so then we had to consider that, and we did. We took it step by step. Now, as far as getting the Sandoz, he told me, and I think the package that arrived was in my name, but it could have been in the center's. It was a plain brown because I received it, and I took it to Bob and Connie and said, here we have it. I remember the acting out. I got it in the kitchen, and I took it in the office.
Did you get it from Sandoz or from Vancouver, British Columbia? Where?
I don't know, because it was plain. It could have come from, it seemed fairly quick to come from Sandoz. I think it might have even been something that, because of Craig being in the CIA, it might have been from that direction, too. But anyway, it was 2,000 doses.
Yeah, where he says 100 milligrams. The prescribed amount was 100 micrograms per dose. He says Sandoz would send 100 milligrams. And what are you saying? 2,000?
Well, 2,000 doses.
Is that 2,000 micrograms?
No, each dose was 100.
100 what?
Micrograms.
Right. Each dose was that, and you had 2,000 of those.
So, yeah.
Well, that would, I don't know, how many milligrams is, thousands of micrograms? I guess
a microgram, 1,000 micrograms equals 1 milligram, isn't it?
Yeah, that sounds right, yeah.
Okay, anyway.
So there were 2,000 of those milligrams.
Yes, and it was a white, yellowish-white powder. And in order to measure it, we measured it on electromagnetic scales. But the stuff was so light that we had to, the smallest amount we could measure was 20 doses. So 20 times 100 micrograms was the amount we could get to measure. That's the smallest we could measure.
Mm.
And we would put that in distilled water and keep it in the refrigerator. But the instructions were that within 5 days, there were vagrant molecules that would form that had strychnine in them. Maybe a very small amount, but that's the way it would go. So, to make sure we didn't do anything, everything that we mixed was dumped. If we didn't use up the 20 doses in 5 days, we dumped it. And that's one reason why we felt it was comfortable to have maybe 4 or 5 people in each session, not right away, but after a couple, 3 weeks. Then we started having sessions in which there would be maybe 4 or 5 people taking it for the first time in the same room.
Because you had to get rid of it, so to speak.
Well, we figured we could, you know, and
yeah.
We'd gotten a handle on it, so... That way we didn't, but otherwise there was lots of LSD that went down the drain.
Okay, so the you got the package and you went to Bob McCall and he says, look at this, we got this stuff. What are we going to do?
Well, I just turned it over to him but that's one of the things that had come about in our relationship that they were going to that I was going to be involved in therapy and they were going to handle the rest of it. And then it wasn't very long before they got into it, so they were as involved in the therapy as I was, and then I could step out and they'd continue on with therapy and doing the whole thing, and then I'd come back in. I was like a quasi-director taking some of the sessions, and they were taking more of them, and they were doing actually more therapy sessions than I was, or with more people.
Right, but you're saying that originally the acid came for Dave Wurster, to study Dave Wurster on it.
I think that's why when I took the package, I thought it had my name on it.
Right, but one factor is that he's interested in a group.
It had no return address, by the way. It was a plain brown record with no return address, and it had my name on it.
But the thing is that he is interested in having a group take it, so it might have been singled out for you, but it would eventually become a group, right?
That's right.
Yeah. But it was starting
I was the
you.
Contact point and the chief therapist, trickster.
Yes, because L.A. Craig decided that you seemed to be on top of the experience more than anybody else, so they kind of said, well, let Dave lead this.
And also Hubbard got it. So we...
Hubbard what?
But
Hubbard,
he loved Bob
Hubbard
and Connie.
What? No, what'd you say? Hubbard got it? What do you mean? Hubbard what? Hubbard would be leader? Is that, what are you just saying?
No, Hubbard came and saw me and saw the way it had to go, and then at a certain point, he spent more time with Bob and Connie. And Bob and Connie traveled more. In other words, the details of the operation, they already had as the center. And all it had to do was, and it also gave them control.
Yeah.
They never had to feel they didn't have control. And I think that was important to Bob.
Right.
And somewhat to Connie, but they didn't, I don't think we ever had any attitude, unless Bob had one himself, about my key involvement as being some kind of a control. I think they just decided, well, we'll just use it.
What you could do.
Yeah. And learn, and because I was the discoverer of most of the keys that came about in the therapy.
Okay, well, we got to end now, so we will continue with that point, the keys. And I want to end just for the listener to see, here is who Hubbard is, and the first few lines in the Wikipedia. Alfred Matthew Hubbard, born in 1901, died August 31st, 1982, became a freelance, in quotes, freelance apostle for the drug LSD in the early 1950s. The controversial captain, in quotes, Al Hubbard, is considered to be as important to the history of LSD as Aldous Huxley or Dr. Timothy Leary. Although what?
Leary came years later.
Right. But in terms of the popularization of history of LSD, he's a figure. They're saying Huxley and then Leary, Hubbard is equal to them. Although he had no medical training during the 1950s, Hubbard worked at the Hollywood Hospital with Ross McLean, psychiatrist Abram Hoffer, Dr. Humphrey Osmond, Myron Stolaroff, at the International Federation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park, and with Willis Harmon at Stanford Research Institute, running psychedelic sessions with LSD. So...
Yeah, but I don't think they'd gotten down... In other words, they didn't... most of those doctors that you mentioned hadn't come on yet when we first started our sessions.
Right. Humphrey Osmond was doing it maybe up...
There were those that were right up at the hospital.
Yeah.
But then when you get to Stolaroff, now he was not up there. He was later.
Right. And Humphrey Osmond is up in Saskatchewan doing therapy on alcoholics and that, and Hoffer is with him. And so I
think that was in an earlier period. So
yeah, a couple of years or same period maybe. My friend did a documentary on that Canadian Institute up there in Saskatchewan. So.
Yeah. Now he was called a clinical psychologist, and when I talked to Thelma, what's her name, down in California, and she says, "Oh, he just had a mail order diploma."
Who is this? Clinical psychologist is what you're saying Hubbard called himself?
Yeah, that he had, there was a clinic, he was a clinical psychologist, but the guys who worked with him were psychiatrists. So he was like the head of it, but these guys were working for him.
And Thelma said, I was just a mail order.
That he just had a mail order diploma.
Right.
And what you're talking about there, what it says, is probably, it sounds like it's filling out that detail. It's probably so.
What is probably so?
That he had a mail order diploma.
Yeah, because it says, although he had no medical training.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Bob calls him a psychologist, either knowing it was a mail order or didn't know.
Well, the point is, it was later that that was pointed out, much in the 70s that was pointed out. At the time, he was the clinical psychologist who headed this hospital with five psychiatrists. Well, it turns out that it was a wing of the hospital.
Right.
But I, you know, now to me, I thought he was the head of the whole goddamn thing, but apparently he was the head of the whole god wing.
You thought he was the head of the whole hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But I didn't.
It's interesting what's called Hollywood Hospital, thinking of McLuhan's mixed corporate media and mixed media and the Hollywood connection to you and Vern and Bob Carr. It's all embedded in there. But just to end off.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And the psychiatrist, one of them is Abram Hoffer, he wrote a blurb for Carolyn's book a few years ago.
Is that right? But he was, I remember him.
Yeah,
I met him up in Canada. It could have been, I think I only went to the hospital once or twice as far as the grounds and into the thing. And wherever I went, I thought it was it, you know. But there was a friend of ours who was a wealthy man in Vancouver, and he came down to the center a lot.
Would you say that Bob and Connie went to the hospital physically more than you did?
It's possible.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Abram Hoffer went on to invent orthomolecular therapy. A kind of vitamin therapy, I think it
was. Uh-huh.
So, Dave, that's it. We'll continue soon.
Uh-huh. I'm just trying to think. Hoffer. I may have seen him at this couple's home in Vancouver. And if it was him, there's something fairly important happened there. Somebody showed me a replica of the Mona Lisa, and they wanted me to look at it while I was on acid. And I was looking at it, and it seemed to draw in, you know, it's famous for it. And then I think this Hoffer was there while this other guy pointed out to me what the deal was. And it turned out that the painter had painted a spiral. But what he'd done is he'd paint a few little strokes here and then turn and do it from the other side. So you didn't see a line of a spiral. You saw, but unless you looked this way and this way, and then pretty soon you could see that there was this spiral that went through the whole background and down through and then wound up right at her nose. And then, of course, the famous smile. But the background, many people felt it was very unfinished, you know, behind her shoulders.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason it was unfinished so that it would hide the spiral.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do, and I think that Hoffer was somehow or other maybe there and might have even, I don't know whether he pointed it out or the other guy.
Did you, this was in Vancouver, not Saskatchewan?
In Vancouver, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it was, I can't think of their names, but that's all right.
Okay.
All right, lots of light around you.
And pass it on.
And pass it on. Au revoir.
Au revoir. Okay, Scott?